Welcome to African American Conservatives, your source for political news and commentary from a cultural and right-of-center perspective. African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Welcome to African American Conservatives, your source for political news and commentary from a cultural and right-of-center perspective. African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement.
Well, good evening and welcome to African American Conservatives. I guess you know where you are tonight if you heard our intro twice tonight. Our audio seems to have a life of its own. This is your host, Marie Strotter, and tonight we have with us Chris Kyle, U.S. Navy SEAL Team 3 Chief. Chris Kyle served 4 combat tours in Operation Iraqi Freedom and elsewhere. For his bravery in battle, he was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 5 Bronze Stars with Valor, 2 Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medals, and 1 Navy and Marine Corps Commendation. Following his combat deployments, he became chief instructor for training Naval Special Warfare Sniper and Counter-Sniper Teams, and authored the Naval Special Warfare Sniper Doctrine. He is president of Kraft International and a world-class leader in training and security. He lives with his family in Texas, where he devotes most of his time, spare time, to helping disabled veterans. He joins us tonight to discuss his book, American Sniper. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Well, thank you, ma'am, for having me.
You begin the book by saying, quote, "I'm still a bit uncomfortable with the idea of publishing my life story. First of all, I've always thought that if you want to know what life as a SEAL is like, you should go get your own trident, earn our medal, the symbol of who we are, go through our training, make the sacrifices, physical and mental. That's the only way you'll know," end quote. With these expressed misgivings about telling your story, how did American Sniper come about?
Well, I found out that there were 2 other authors out there actively seeking my stories because they wanted to tell it. And I figured if someone was going to tell my story, instead of getting it wrong and then making me come out like I'm arrogant and trying to take all the credit, that then I'm going to tell the story, and that way I make sure the correct people get the credit that actually deserve it.
And how do you still feel that way about telling your story? Just those misgivings?
Well, I definitely have both sides there. I really did not want to have to be the one that feels like I'm trading in my trident to make a dollar off of it. So, you know, I was definitely one of those guys who was a hater on the guys who were doing it, because I felt like the only reason they were doing it was just trying to make money. So for me to counterbalance that, and also I felt it was the only right thing to do because of the guys that I do write about, I feel like if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here today, and I definitely would not be the man I am. So all of my portion of the proceeds of the book are going back to those families and to the wounded vet organizations.
Wonderful. Now that your side of the story is out and it is the way that you wanted to let that story be known, talk us through the reaction that the book has caused. It's I believe, number 1 in its category on Amazon.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you expect that?
No, not at all. I thought the book would do okay, but I never expected this kind of reaction that I've gotten. I mean, it's blown me away, but I've also had, you know, I guess the greatest thing, one of the family members of Ryan Jobe stood in line to get a book signed by me just to show his support and tell me that he thought I did a great deal and that this book was done in the right way. So that right there made it all worth it to me. And then I have other team guys and other military guys writing me emails or calling me saying, "Thank you for doing this. I was in the same spot that you're in, and now I understand." So I definitely feel like that it was done the right way, and the correct people are actually going to get something out of it.
Now, you mentioned Ryan Jobe, and you said that his story affected you greatly. Readers of American Sniper would recognize him as a very special man. Can you tell us about your history and your relationship with this warrior?
Definitely. Ryan was an amazing human. I mean, he was one of my best friends, and he was a guy that when he first came into the teams, he wasn't readily accepted because he wasn't the SEAL shape. He wasn't exactly in top physical condition. And, you know, we definitely tried to push him out or try to find fault with him so that we could justify him going away. But this guy had such a huge heart, you couldn't make him quit. He just kept coming. And we told him, you know, hey, you messed up doing this, messed up doing that. He corrected it. So it's just, he had a heart of gold. And, you know, I still to this day strive to be more like him. And then, you know, unfortunately, out there on the battlefield, he did end up giving his life. He was shot one day in a position that I put him in. And, you know, 3 years after the fact of being shot, living those 3 years as blind, he finally died on the in the recovery room.
Wow. Now, interestingly, you share in the book that you were initially turned down by the SEALs. What happened?
Well, it wasn't the SEALs I was trying for at the time. I was just trying to join the military. I tried to join the Marine Corps. But, you know, I had a rodeo accident that I had been involved in, and I had pins and screws put in my arm. And at the time, that was not common practice, and the Navy did not see that as something they were willing to overlook or give a waiver for. So I was just denied entrance into the military. Over time, I guess recruitment numbers got low enough to where they went through their database and started calling up people who had applied. They finally got to my name and called and said, hey, if you really want in, you can come in now. So I went back to go talk to the Marine recruiter, and the Marine recruiter was out to lunch. So as I was leaving that little strip mall where all the separate recruiters were, I was approached by the Army and by the Navy and told, hey, you can be a Navy SEAL right now. And I was told about everything the SEALs do and thought, wow, well, not everything, but was told what the recruiter wanted me to know about them and thought, wow, those guys are really awesome. And so I decided, you know what? That's the deal for me. I'm going to go be a SEAL.
Now, in American Sniper, as we've mentioned, which has turned into just a runaway monumental bestseller, other books have been also relating to the SEALs, including SEAL Team 6, Warrior Soul, SEAL Target, Geronimo, SEAL of Honor, Lone Survivor, and the upcoming film Act of Valor. It was only a few years ago when the only mention of the SEALs in popular culture was the Charlie Sheen B-movie from 1990. So now, even before the death of Osama bin Laden, people were taken with all things SEALs. Why are the SEALs suddenly so popular, in your opinion, and is this reverence or notoriety always a good thing?
Well, the notoriety is not always a good thing. But I do believe that different factions, whether it be the military themselves or politicians for their political gain, are definitely putting it out there to promote their own agendas. But, you know, at the same time, it's not necessarily a bad thing because now the recruitment numbers are definitely coming up. You know, people are finding out a little bit more of that SEALs are out there, and we're definitely getting more and better people involved into the community that we normally wouldn't be able to recruit. But then again, looking back at the SEAL's take on it, then it's not really a good thing because you never want to be known for what you're doing. And the only time people should find out is when you mess up.
And I think maybe just in popular culture, like the Charlie Sheen movie, or, you know, the popularity of shows like NCIS, you know, where we see it's not necessarily about the SEALs, but naval life, kind of glamorizes the life a little bit. And, you know, everything doesn't end up neatly packaged at the end of an hour or 2 hours.
No, it's definitely not neatly packaged up. It definitely comes with its hardships, and being a Navy SEAL is awesome. You know, I loved it and would never discourage anyone from wanting to go and do that. They definitely treated me extremely well, but at the same time, it comes with its hardships. I mean, when there's a war, we do not go in to do the village building and win the hearts and minds. We are going in to fix problems, so you are going into contested areas, and it is going to be tough.
Now, an underlying theme of American Sniper is the effect that deployment has upon one's family. And you're quite open about the effect that it had on yours, including the strain it put on your relationship with your wife, particularly when you became an almost absentee father of two. But you were able to overcome this strain, and many women and men in the military are not so fortunate. Is this strain avoidable, perhaps with shorter deployments and longer leaves?
Well, I mean, the military is definitely working on trying to accommodate its troops and have more home time. Now, whether they do that in the deployments or if they're trying, like in our training cycle before you go overseas, most of our training is still gone from home. So they are trying to minimize the time that you are gone from home as much as they can. And I'm definitely not trying to defend them and say they're perfect. There's definitely problems with it, but they have addressed it, and they are trying to resolve the situation. But, you know, me, I did not give my family my all. I definitely gave my job number one priority, and you can serve your time, your 20, 30 years in the military and have a great relationship with your wife and your kids, but I did it wrong. So that's why in this book I'm trying to show that you need to give a little bit more and you can make it work.
Now, you said in the book that wounded soldiers need more than our sympathy. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? What more could we and should we be doing for our wounded veterans?
Right. Well, these guys, they don't want your sympathy. The first time that anyone ever really tried or started treating them really nice was when they were wounded. In the military, we're always extremely hard on each other. So when they get wounded and then all of a sudden like, oh, hey, are you okay? They know something's wrong. So, no, they don't need our sympathy. They need to be taken care of. They need to know that they are still loved and that we are here for them. But they don't need our sympathy. They just need our thanks and our approval and just, you know, help them with their problems. But don't treat them like degenerates or outcasts.
My uncle served in Vietnam, and I had another friend at church who also did. And one of the things that they that I've heard, and I've heard this from other returning veterans, you know the whole thing in Vietnam about the baby killers, and you know when they came home, they were spat upon and treated so poorly for trying to defend our freedoms abroad, and. You know, just the lack of respect, regardless of how people might feel about the act of war itself as a political ideology. But these are people who give their lives every day for our basic freedoms. And have you experienced any of that when you came home, the way that people treated you?
Well, I can never compare myself and my war with the Vietnam vets, because we did have the majority of the support of the population. But there is definitely still a faction of the population who do look down on us because we did go and serve. But people just need to understand, when we sign up for the military, we're signing up because we love this country. we're not signing up because we think certain policies are going to be written and that we're going to go defend those policies. We signed up to go protect this country, and then the politicians are the ones that decide where we go. All we're saying is, yes, I vow to defend this country and do what this country says is best. And those politicians, if you don't agree with the war, protest them, but leave the troops alone. All they're doing is saying, hey, I love this country. I just want to help.
One of the issues we hear a lot about, even though, as you've said, we don't, that veterans don't want our sympathy, there are some things that we can do, specifically in the area of mental health. You know, a lot of our returning soldiers struggle with post-traumatic stress and other issues, and it seems that there could be done more to reintegrate these warriors, given, you know, the horrendous images that, they must carry with them from battle. Can you talk to us a little bit about what we could do?
Definitely. I mean, PTSD is definitely a real thing that people do face on a day-to-day basis. And not everybody coming back has PTSD. I do believe a lot of the guys coming home have combat stress, which, you know, you have your initial shock at coming home because you were just in the combat zone. That will fade. But these guys that have PTSD, they're not outcasts. They just, you know, they have a certain problem with the act of killing someone or of a dramatic situation that they were involved in, and they need to be treated the same as any other vet, but just, you know, give them your shoulder. Listen to them. You know, they're not asking to be treated any different either. They just want to be treated like the hero that they are, but they're actually coming out saying, yes, I do have a certain problem with this event or these events that I went through, and I do need some help. But it is manageable, and these people are not to be outcast or looked down upon.
Well, you know, my husband and I were talking last night about this, just in the wake of what happened with some of the things that are in the news. There was a celebrity who committed suicide, and then, you know, as we saw the horrible incident in Washington with the Powell family. And we were saying, you know, that when someone has a mental illness, that there is such a stigma about it, and that we make things harder by not just talking about it, that if someone were suffering from PTSD or some other mental health issue, especially someone who is viewed as a hero or someone who's supposed to be a really tough guy and you're supposed to not cry or, you know, you're supposed to hold all that in, our society, our culture makes that a very difficult step to take because of the stigma associated with some of those things. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely, 100%. I mean, there shouldn't be a stigma associated with it because these guys and girls are true heroes. They've done what their country has asked, and now it's their time for the country to give back for them for doing so. You know, and at the same time, these people, they just need help. And then, you know, even while in the process of getting this help, they are still average, everyday Americans. You know, they went above and beyond. They saw some things that normal people don't see. But, you know, they definitely demand our respect.
Can you tell us a little bit about, we talked earlier about Lone Survivor, and you mentioned the author of that incredible tale, Marcus Luttrell, and you speak about him being, that you were torn up from the news of his plight. Can you convey to our audience your relationship with him and how his battle affected you so deeply?
Definitely. Marcus is a very close friend of mine. We have basically grown up in the teams together. And when that whole ordeal went down with him, I was stateside, and I was on the call to be able to be the ones to go in to help get him out. And, you know, I never got that call because we did figure out what happened with him. But, yeah, he's an extremely close friend of mine. And it's just like a brother or a family member, all of a sudden went missing, or, you know, you found out all his buddies died, then yes, it's gonna hit you hard. And I remember exactly, it was the 4th of July when he was still gone. I was watching the fireworks, and 4th of July is one of my favorite holidays. I love watching the fireworks and what everything stands for of that holiday, and I could not find joy in that day.
You have written, quote, "I'm not the same guy I was when I first went into war," end quote. Can you explain the significant ways in which you've changed?
Definitely. I mean, when you go into combat and you're seeing life and death situations on a day-to-day basis, then all of a sudden you come home and you hear about all these troubles that everyone's having, you start to kind of look at them and go, are you kidding me? That's really a problem to you? I just almost died, and this is a problem. This is trivial. So it does kind of put things into better perspective of, like, this isn't a big problem. This is overcomable. You can handle this. But, you know, at the same time, then you are a little more hardened because of being in war. I mean, war is hell. You never wish that upon anyone.
You write, quote, "A lot of people, not just politicians, wanted to impose ridiculous fantasies on us, hold us to some standard of behavior that no human being could maintain," end quote. We saw an example of this in 2009 when three SEALs were charged with the assault and potential court-martial for giving Abed, who was the mastermind of the murder and mutilation of four Americans in Fallujah, a fat lip. Are the men and women we send into war being supported by the men and women we send to Washington, in your experience, especially as it relates to rules of engagement that sometimes seem to be for the benefit of politicians rather than for American soldiers? This is a topic we've talked about extensively with Congressman Alan West, as you know, who served in the military for 22 years. What is your take on that?
Well, I don't know what Mr. West's opinion is on that, but I can tell you that I highly respect that man, and I wish he would run for president. But
I know.
On the other hand, you know, not knowing where he stands on that, no, I think most politicians do not stand behind the troops because, first of all, our rules of engagement are written by congressmen who are sitting in their desk in a nice, comfortable, safe position and telling us when we should feel threatened and when we're able to fire back. Excuse me. I do believe that we need rules of engagement. There are constantly evolving roles and stages in the war, and the troops on the ground definitely need to know and understand what those are. But for someone in Congress to be writing it, I think it's ridiculous. I think it should be the commanders on the ground telling Washington, this is the stage of war we're in right now, and here's what our troops are going to be abiding by.
What is your reaction to the report that, according to the Army Times, quote, "some troops will begin receiving less imminent danger pay when a new policy takes effect that will prorate the standard 225 monthly IDP stipend under the new policy? Troops will be paid only for the actual days they spend in the danger pay location."
Well, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, first of all, for a military member to actually retire, because I only did 10 years and 9 months, I was 3 months short of 11 years, I see zero out of the military. Even though I put my life on the line for almost 11 years, I get nothing out of the military for it. Now, you got congressmen who will go and serve one term and get 100% of their retirement for the rest of their lives. And then half of the laws they write, they don't even have to abide by anyway. No, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, for military, we have to serve at least 20 years, and that gives us 50% of that measly little paycheck that we get.
Now, how were you able to finally walk away from the SEALs?
It was definitely tough. I mean, I felt like I was letting my guys down because when I left, I felt like someone else had to take my spot, and I was going to feel horrible if, you know, I found out that person was injured or killed. But at the same time, I have a family. And when my wife told me that you need to choose which one's it going to be, said, okay, easy enough. I'm going to choose my family this time.
Wow. Now, another topic we've talked about quite a bit on the show with Congressman West and other people with a military background such as yours, your training included some tactics that could be considered torture. You know, that whole conversation about enhanced interrogation techniques versus torture. And I think there are a lot of people who don't understand that distinction. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think people need to get over themselves. We've got terrorists out there that are beheading us, dragging us down the street behind their vehicles, hanging us up on bridges and burning us, disemboweling guys alive, shoving their genitals in their mouth. This interrogation techniques, you know, they're saying waterboarding is, you know, torture. But just about every military member from the United States is waterboarded. That's part of our training, folks. So I can't understand why it's okay to do it to our own troops, but we can't do it to these other people who don't even abide by the Geneva Convention.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, we talked to Congressman West about his situation where he was trying to extract information from a detainee and, you know, shot the gun over his head. And, you know, we mentioned the fat lip and, you know, some of the things that we have witnessed. And I remember what Congressman West said in response to the more recent information about the men who urinated on the corpses. And he was just talking about just what you said, that, you know, people were disemboweled in Fallujah and, you know, where was the righteous indignation there? And it just seems that this is another one of those issues where we are encountering people who don't like us very much, and there's always that balance to extract information that will keep us safe versus, you know, honoring what the, you know, conventions are.
No, I 100% agree with him. And another thing on those Marines urinating on those dead bodies, yeah, I mean, that's unfortunate that someone was standing there and filming that, but for people to actually judge those Marines, unless you have actually been in their shoes and know their mental status, because we don't even know the whole story. You don't know what went on the day before that, the hour before that, or the week before that, where they've been losing guys left and right. And now all of a sudden, you know, they're pumped up. They finally got the guys who've been getting them. And then, yeah, they're taking, you know, emotions got a hold of them. But unless you've been there, you should never judge those guys. Those guys are putting their lives on the line, and so they acted out, just like a kid in school. But that kid in school, do you send him to juvie for the, you know, and ruin his life? No. You, I mean, maybe you should slap him on the hand or give him a demotion, but do not judge these guys. These guys are put in life and death situations daily. And I am just so super proud of these guys out there fighting for us that I am not about to come down on them.
Now, it says, as we talked about in the introduction, in your spare time, that you do a lot with disabled veterans. What are the projects that you're involved with, and how can we best help?
Well, when I first made the transition into becoming a civilian, I went into a big depression. Because not only was I a SEAL, that's what identified me. That's who I was. So now I was having to find my whole new identity again. And I went into this dark place and started drinking. And all of a sudden, for some reason, one day it just snapped and I started working out again. And once I got my my body back into shape, then I was able to get my mind right. So I approached this company called Fitco. And the Fed, because they supplied gym equipment to Gold's 24-Hour Fitness and stuff like that. I said, what if we took some of that stuff that you were going to throw away or sell and bought it at a discounted price to put in these guys' homes to get their bodies back? They formed this whole new nonprofit organization that's exactly what they're doing. They're putting these gyms in these vets' homes that either are disabled or need emotional help, and also providing counselors, trainers, I mean, trying to get these guys back on the right track. And, I mean, that's fitcocares.org or even Troops First, which is another organization that's taking these guys out. We're doing retreats for these guys to get them out to ranches, to go hunting, fishing, just doing things to get them out away from the hospitals, because we feel that the healing time doubles when they're out from the hospital and just outside enjoying the outdoors among other guys who are going to treat them as an equal. I mean, these guys are doing awesome. Their spirits are soaring. Anything you can do to help out with the vets, and it doesn't even have to be an organization. If you know a vet, cook them a meal, mow their yard, babysit so they can go on a date, or even just as simple as take a nap. I mean, all you got to do is just give a little bit of your time, and it's going to mean a mountain to these guys.
Now, Chris, in the book, you mentioned that your daughter was diagnosed with leukemia. Can you give us an update on her condition today, and is there anything that our listeners can do to help?
Actually, she was misdiagnosed.
She
did have jaundice. Her kidneys were failing, but it was not leukemia.
Wonderful.
It was something that she did grow out of, and she is a perfectly normal and healthy young girl today. And I'm very happy to have my entire family is extremely healthy and happy.
Praise God. Chris, what's next for you?
Well, in your introduction, I'm working with Craft International, and we're just trying to still do my part by giving back and training the law enforcement who are going to be the first responders here at home, and also our military, trying to help to give them any kind of opportunity I can so they can have a one-up when they go downrange. But other than that, my main goal is making sure that these vets are taken care of and that they are not only said thank you, but showed thank you, and doing everything I can to help all these guys, whether it's job training, you know, anything physically, mentally. I feel like it's my duty to give back to them now.
Absolutely. For your listening to the show tonight, please check out these nonprofits that Chris has mentioned, as well as contacting your local Blue Star Moms or Gold Star Moms. We have a Blue Star Mom that is a friend of mine, and my kids, you know, make little thank you cards during special times throughout the year. So please make sure that you take care of our people who are returning. Chris, thank you so much for being our guest tonight and sharing your story with us.
Thank you, ma'am, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jim DeMint has served South Carolina as United States Senator since 2005. He is a member of the Republican Party and a leading member of the conservative movement. He previously served as the United States Representative for South Carolina's 4th Congressional District from 1999 to 2005. Welcome back to the show, Senator DeMint.
Marie, thanks for having me, and thanks for what you do every day. One of the things we learned in the last election is that getting people informed and engaged through a radio talk show is one of the most powerful weapons we have.
Well, thank you so much. I'm actually actively working on behalf of one of the campaigns, doing all of the social media for the state, as well as some of the phone banking. So I really take what you say to heart. It's not just that we have forums like this where we talk about it, but actually getting citizens involved and working for a cause, because we've got to change the tide this year. You describe Now or Never as a call to action. And in keeping with this theme of urgency and its imperative tone, you say that, quote, establishment critics say that those of us who warn about America's massive debt and impending economic collapse are alarmists. They're correct. The status quo is demonstrably unsustainable, and it is unquestionably time to sound the alarm, end quote. You later add, there has never been a time in America's history when it has been more necessary and urgent for citizens to stand up
and take back our government. President Barack Obama, Congress, and the Federal Reserve are out of control as they spend us into oblivion and print money to buy our own debt, end quote. Please expand upon your argument that our current economic predicament makes this election historically significant, and please tell us as well of the consequences if President Obama is reelected and conservatives fail to take over the Senate.
Well, Marie, I think Americans are cynical about Washington politicians crying wolf when there's no wolf or talking about one crisis after another. It'd be easy to miss the fact that our country's never been at this point before where our debt is larger than our economy, with plans to double that debt. There's just not that much money in the whole world for us to borrow, and that's why we're printing it. That's why the Federal Reserve has bought the majority of our debt the last 2 years. This is not sustainable. It wouldn't be even sustainable at this point if the euro wasn't in such trouble. But the euro is either going to go down or recover, but one way or another, the American dollar and our whole economy is going to be subject to some of the dominoes that are starting to fall around the world. So on one side of the equation, we are heavily in debt. We borrow about $120, $130 billion every month just to keep going. So every dollar we spend as a federal government, I think about 43 cents of that is borrowed. So almost half of everything we're spending now is borrowed. We can't keep that up any longer. The problem we have at election time is about half of Americans now are getting something from government, and the other half is paying for it. And those who want more from government or are dependent on government are very well organized in the Democrat Party. And that's why the Democrats are in a position where they can't cut spending. They can't balance the budget. Their whole platform is based on promising more from government. You know, if we were helping people, it's one thing. But we know making people dependent on the government doesn't help them. But these scare tactics, these false promises of more security or more income have not come true. But the problem we have today when people vote, the ones who want more from government are pretty well organized and motivated. The rest of America is not well organized. Those who are paying taxes, working, and we just have to unite Americans of all kinds, libertarians, independents, those who don't care anything about politics, conservatives, everyone who understands American exceptionalism has got to get organized in this election. I really think it could be the last chance we have to turn things around. We can't take four more years of what's happened the last three. And we need a new Senate, too. We cannot afford to have a Congress that cannot produce a balanced budget.
You're absolutely right. You know, as I mentioned to you earlier, I homeschool my three children, and I think about this, you know, in terms of how they must see this. And looking back, you know, when hopefully they're my age, and they look back, will they see this as a pivotal moment in our history? And I think that they will. And I think the question then becomes, well, what did you do?
Yeah.
And I think all of us have to take some sort of action to prevent this cataclysmic event.
Yeah, and that's really what I write about, is that every individual can do something. And and folks who think they're powerless, they're not. I mean, and I point out in the book, if we get a few calls in our office about something, I mean, we listen. If we get 100 calls, I mean, it starts getting everybody moving in some direction. And we've seen on big bills, the big amnesty immigration bill, when thousands of people around the country got engaged, that what was supposed to pass easily did not pass. And we have a chance to change things. And so we just have to get people engaged and informed. It's hard, because I know when I watch the news about what I did in a given day, that sometimes it doesn't even resemble what happened. So finding a news source that you can trust, and I think that's why a lot of people listen to your show, is that they can get a perspective they trust. But we've got to understand that America was built as a bottom-up nation. We've never been perfect, but we were exceptional and prosperous, the strongest nation in the world, because we were millions of people making our own decisions at the family level, the local level, the church level. And now, over the last several decades, more and more power and money and control has moved to Washington, D.C., and things aren't working as well. The economy's not working as well. People don't have as many job opportunities. Families are coming unglued, and we can turn it around, but we probably only have another few months and maybe a year to turn it around on our own terms. Because once things start collapsing and we end up like Greece, somebody else is making the decisions for us. The people who give us credit, the people who give us oil, and those are people who are not necessarily our friends.
And you're absolutely right. I think we've taken the wrong approach in this, in that, you know, we listen to the sound bites from the mainstream media, and it's, you know, our culture is so absorbed with reality TV that it's almost, you know, like voting someone off of Survivor or, you know, some sort of American Idol contest, you know, where the most popular person is the person that we vote for rather than really investigating what someone believes. Because
yeah.
It's very easy to be glib and smooth and say all the right things. But it's a little different when you dig into what the person actually has voted on or what their voting record is.
Yeah, I've got a whole chapter in Now and Never about how to pick the right candidate and what's involved with understanding their competence, their courage, and other aspects. Their character is important, and you can see that over the course of their lives. It's not just what the media says about them, but have they run something successfully? Have they managed their family successfully? Have they been a volunteer in the community? Have they been charitable? I mean, character doesn't change when you're elected to public office. And we to elect someone who can just give a good speech, who's inspiring, we've got to look a little deeper than that. And I think Americans have woken up. But we need to double our efforts from 2010, and I think we can change things, but we need to unite all Americans who believe in the idea of individual liberty and individual responsibility and get them together for this election to turn things around.
In Now or Never, you go into detail as to how Social Security will, quote, exacerbate our spending and debt problems, end quote. One of your suggestions to address this problem would be to give all retired and retiring seniors with alternative sources of income the option of taking a tax-free lump sum payment equal to one-half of their projected actuarial payout. If my estimated payout at 65 years old over the next 10 or 15 years is $250,000, I would gladly take a lump sum of $125,000 the day I retired. If only a small percentage of seniors took this option, it would save the country billions of dollars, end quote. Is this an idea that simply just makes too much common sense to come to pass? Or are there other reasons why Democrats so staunchly oppose this and other entitlement suggestions?
Democrats know that a dependent voter is a dependable vote. When we're dependent on the government, they can manipulate, they can scare us. That's and everything for them is more central control. That means they can control more.
Yes.
But, you know, even if people said, okay, I don't want a lump sum, I just have a feeling that a lot of people with alternative sources of income would just take about half. It would leave more in the system for those who really need it and don't have an alternative source of income. So instead of immediately saying, let's cut the benefits people get on Social Security, let's see if we can give some people a choice to buy them out at a lower price or give younger workers 401k-style plans that are less expensive but more desirable for a younger worker who doesn't believe the government's going to take care of their retirement plan. We don't have to start this thing by cutting benefits for people who've paid for them.
Now, much of this book, as has much of your career, has been focused upon the family feud between establishment Republicans, many of whom, as you point out, have attempted to thwart your every move as senator, and those of us who consider ourselves to be conservatives. Many people, especially on the conservative side of this fight, see this rift demonstrated in the nomination race currently between Governor Romney and Speaker Gingrich. Sarah Palin, for example, has long railed against establishment Republicans and has reiterated her attack against them, claiming this whole thing isn't really about Newt Gingrich versus Mitt Romney. It's about the GOP establishment versus the Tea Party grassroots and independent Americans who are sick of the politics of personal destruction, end quote. Do you agree that this nomination is a battle, in fact, a battle between the establishment and conservatism?
Not at all. I don't buy that at all. Actually, Mitt Romney's the only one who hadn't spent his life in Washington, so I don't know how he got pegged with being the establishment. But I see the Tea Party pretty divided, and that's really why we don't have a consensus candidate. A lot of my supporters in South Carolina were for Romney. Some were even for Ron Paul. They just want Ron Paul listened to on some issues. I don't think a lot of people think he can actually win, but he's attracted a pretty large following because he's talking about some things like the Federal Reserve that the other candidates aren't. Rick Santorum's a great friend, and I think he's got some Tea Party support, a lot of social conservatives. And, of course, Newt has some conservatives, too. But I just don't think you can say there's one conservative in the race and the other aren't. And I really don't think this election's going to come down to the political labels of who's the most conservative. I think you're going to see that this comes down to the Republican who shows the most fight, the most toughness. Because we know we need a president who will do something like Chris Christie's tried to do in New Jersey or Scott Walker in Wisconsin, who take on the establishment, the government unions. And so I think that's why you see the polls changing a little bit in Florida as Romney stood up and showed some toughness and he's gone on the attack himself. That's what helped Newt Gingrich in South Carolina. But I don't buy the idea that one's establishment and one's not. I just don't think that's the defining thing here. Obviously, I'm anti-establishment, but I don't think you can peg someone who's never been in Washington as the establishment candidate.
Now, speaking of Governor Romney, many argue that he, as a Northeastern moderate governor, should look to shore up where he is perceived as weak and help unite the party for its campaign against President Obama by picking someone as a running mate who is a popular senator of, say, a southern state like South Carolina, a leader of the Tea Party movement, and someone who not only endorsed him in 2007, but whose wife, Debbie, was a women's leadership team co-chair during his 2007 campaign. Would you know of anyone like that, and do you think he would accept such an offer?
Well, you know, I wouldn't recommend anyone pick a VP from South Carolina because South Carolina is going to vote for the Republican nominee. But if he picks someone like a Marco Rubio from Florida, I don't know if Marco would do it, but he would certainly give conservatives a sense that that they were part of the ticket. And Florida is a swing state, very important. And I think bringing in minorities in the Republican Party, African American, Hispanics, are really important to the future of our country. So it's I would recommend he look somewhere else. We'll see how that turns out. But I'd sure try to talk him out of it if he called me.
Every time you're on the show, I try to talk you into something. So I thought I'd give it a shot. So far, you've not been photographed on a tarmac waving your finger in President Obama's face. And given how many copies of Governor Brewer's book sold because of that incident, perhaps you should be. But you do make comments about him in your book that some might consider controversial. In Now or Never, you state, quote, President Obama is anti-business. President Obama's policies are also anti-American, end quote. How do you justify these statements to your critics?
Well, I want to be careful to say this is not personal. I like Barack Obama. He came into the Senate the same time I do. He and Michelle and their two daughters are, you know, wonderful first family. But the policies are just completely the opposite of what makes America exceptional. We are a very decentralized country, and that's what the Constitution put into law, is you had most of the power at the state and local level, and individuals made most of their own decisions. So the president's tendency to want to, as he says, partner with business is a socialistic tendency, and I'm not trying to call him names, but when you try to concentrate power in Washington on health care and energy and transportation, and I list the things in the book that the federal government now is in almost complete control of, our banks and financial system, this is anathema to American exceptionalism. So I'm not saying he's anti-American in a sense he doesn't like our country, but his policies are not consistent with the principles that make this country exceptional. In fact, they're completely the opposite.
Under energy freedom, you write, quote, when President Obama took office, the price of a gallon of gasoline was $1.83. 2 years later, gas prices had nearly doubled to more than $3.60. Part of the reason for this, the Obama administration had delayed drilling and mining permits, dramatically expanded nuisance environmental regulations, and bypassed Congress to begin regulating CO2. President Obama's policies resulted in thousands of jobs lost in the energy sector, and higher gas prices drained billions from the American economy. Yet, despite a worsening economy and stubbornly high unemployment, the Obama administration wouldn't relent, and the administration continued to sacrifice jobs to satisfy the environmentalist left, end quote. Now, we saw this in the rejection of the Keystone Pipeline, the moratorium on drilling in the Gulf, and initiatives such as Solyndra, not too far from where I live, actually, and the Chevy Volt. Should the government be involved in the energy market at all beyond ensuring public safety and collecting tax revenue? If so, what actions would you like to see the government take that will both protect the environment but won't cost us the thousands of lost jobs and billions in lost revenue that seem to be the result of President Obama's greenest agenda?
Well, there are a lot of things I'd like to see happen. I mean, I'd love to see a lot more solar and wind, geoenergy. The problem we have is when we try to pick winners and losers from Washington, that the unintended consequences, like we've seen with Solyndra, are worse than the situation would be if we hadn't done anything, and we tend to waste money and we hurt those that are actually succeeding in those fields. I've had people in the solar industry saying, hey, they've been at this 30 years, they're moving ahead, the markets are developing, and if the federal government would just stop coming in and giving money to competitors who don't have as good of products, they would be just fine. So the whole idea of central planning is this naive thought that we can somehow centrally plan economics. We can't. We just need to make sure there's a level playing field, that there's good competition, that the big oil companies can't make it hard for solar companies and nuclear companies to develop. We need to make sure that the antitrust laws are enforced. We basically just need to have a good law and order system and let the market move. Now, we obviously need incentives, and we need to protect our air and our water. But the things that we're doing now for negligible results are so costly that no cost-benefit analysis would tell us to do it. There's some things we need to keep doing, and actually air and water is getting cleaner and cleaner. We've got standards in place, and we need to keep doing that. So I'm not suggesting in any way that we let the capitalist guys out there run roughshod over our environment. But what we have to look at is that the things, and Gallup just came out with this, the things people here in this country want more than anything and around the world is just to have a good job.
Yes.
To have a job that pays enough so they live the way they want and have some satisfaction of using your talents. But if we keep killing the economy, more and more Americans, like we see in so many other countries, are just plagued the whole life with the just – a job that does not satisfy or challenge or pay. And so the best thing we can do is create the best environment in the world to do business, make sure there are reasonable regulations so that people aren't harmed. But Americans have got to have hope for a good job for their children and grandchildren.
Well, and to be able to pay off this incredible debt that is now on our backs and the backs of our children and grandchildren. My daughter, last year I was telling her about this, and she was saying, well, no one asked us if we wanted to pay those taxes. You know, she can't hold a job at 9 years of age. She's 10 now. And my 13-year-old, I'm pushing towards, he's been doing robotics since he was in first grade. I've been pushing him to develop an app or something and become, you know, a little mini millionaire at 16, because flipping burgers isn't going to help him pay off this debt.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we want him to aspire to be a millionaire and not to stigmatize it. And in America, despite what you're hearing from the president, the average person who makes $1 million in our country does it for 2 or 3 years. 50% only do it for 1 year. So this is something that people work towards. You know, they work all their lives. They might make a big salary for a few years, and then they go down the other side, and someone like your children replaces them. But I don't know if any of my four children will ever make $1 million. But I want them to try. I want them to try to do well. And when they do, it helps all the people around them. it creates jobs. It inspires us to innovate, and that helps the whole economy and the whole country. So we don't want to stigmatize success. And if your son ever does make $1 million, I hope the government doesn't take 60% or 70% of what he makes. Otherwise, you're not going to spend a life of, you know, blood, sweat, and tears to get there if somebody's going to take it from you.
You know, I saw it broken down in a much easier way to understand, because when we talk about money and we talk about this class warfare that I believe that the president is engaging in, you know, people get a little funny. But I heard an example that really clarified it for a lot of people. And they said in a classroom, let's say that there's someone who a professor that will not fail you, but nor will he grant you an A. So the best that you can get walking in is a B. And, you know, he gave the first test, and sure enough, people got a B. Well, the highest achievers, the people who made the curve slant towards the B, were not happy with that because they wanted the A, but they couldn't get the A. So they didn't work as hard. And so, you know, slowly over time, the class got closer and closer to an F, because those who had worked so hard chose not to work anymore or quite as hard because they couldn't reap the reward of their study. And the people who didn't want to work very hard just didn't do very much at all, because they just rode on the coattails of the people who had studied. And that's the kind of system that we're living in right now, where American exceptionalism isn't valued and it's stigmatized, and it encourages people not to want to work towards that, because then you're one of the, you know, 1% that is so ill-labeled.
Yeah. Well, earned success is one of the greatest satisfaction of life. I mean, again, I just saw a psychological study, and you can't replace the freedom, the sense of accomplishment of earned success at any level. And when children do it, when you let them do things themselves, and they see they can do things themselves, and when we start replacing that with just making people dependent, and you're right, you steal their motivation and their desire after a while if you start giving them the same reward for whether they work or don't work. So we've got to turn things around. We know what works. We're still time to do it. But this could be now or never for our country. And I hope people will take a moment to read the book. It's the playbook for 2012 and for America's future. It's everything I know and think we need to do. And I've been joined by a number of other conservatives like Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Pat Toomey, Tom Coburn have helped to write sections of the book. And if you want to know what to do to turn our country around, it's in that book.
Now, you have said in a recent interview that, quote, if we spread ourselves too thin around the world, we're not going to be able to defend the homeland, particularly with the level of debt we have right now. Our Joint Chief of Staff for our military has said our biggest national security problem is our debt. So it's foolish for us to think that we can have military bases all over the world and spend billions of dollars when we're going broke back home. It just isn't going to happen. So the best way to make sure we can defend our interests around the world, but we're not in a position to do what we've been doing over the last few decades. What reforms do you believe we can make to reduce our military spending without reducing our national defense, especially in light of an Islamic fascism movement that seems to be spreading throughout the Middle East as well as Africa and Latin America?
Right. Well, we need to make sure that our allies do their fair share. They've left too much to the United States, and we can't be the sugar daddy anymore. We're the world's largest debtor at this point. And we have to make sure that we can not only defend our homeland, but defend America's interests and participate with our allies in defending the free world. But we can't do that if we continue the model we've had in the past, where we've got dozens and dozens of bases around the world. We have to use technology, our ability to move our forces around, whether they're in the Navy with our large battleships, troop carriers, which they're now cutting back on because of our budget. But I don't know the exact plan, but I know we need to re-envision the role that our military plays. We need to make sure that we have the ability to shoot down any missile or any weapon. We have not had the commitment there that we need. And so we need to defend ourselves, and we need to know that we cannot keep trying to transplant democracies and nations that aren't ready for it. It's just unfortunate, but sometimes you just have to be the city on the hill and the example so that other nations will know how to be the free nation instead of where we are now, where people can look at us as an entitlement state, heavily indebted, in a culture that's deteriorating because of a lot of bad government policies. We've got to be that city on the hill. We can't just try to be the sugar daddy around the world and the world's policeman.
Wise words from Senator Jim DeMint. As always, thank you so much for being our guest. I appreciate so much what you do for this country.
Thank you, Marie. And again, thank you for what you do every day.
Thank you. Bye-bye. If you're just joining us, our guest has been Senator Jim DeMint. His latest book is called Now or Never, and it is available in bookstores everywhere. This is your host today, Marie Strotter, for African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement.
Thank you for listening to African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Please visit our website at www.AfricanAmericanConservative.com. There you'll find links to this show, as well as our social networking feeds for Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, YouTube, and our blog. Music by the Afronauts at PodSafe Music. All opinions presented are those of African American Conservatives and our guests. Copyright 2010.